Robert Campbell. It's 5 p.m. Central Time. Keeping the Faith with Steve Shoemaker is next.
This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Our guest today is David Eisenman. We're going to be talking about a Christian view of U.S. prison policy. Welcome, David.
How are you, Steve?
Now, shall we start off by talking about the prison in Guantanamo, Cuba, or shall we finish with that?
Or Abu Ghraib in Iraq.
Right. In terms of U.S. prison policy, why are you interested in it?
Steve, I think it might. Personal interest in prison policy, I suppose, dates back at least a quarter of a century. As we were chatting before this program began, I mentioned to you, I guess I could call myself a crime victim. Twice in my life, I've run into people who violated my person or property, and I've followed what happened to them through the system. But I think that actually my stronger interest in the subject dates to my discovery around 1979 or 1980 that my country, of which I'm very proud and happy to be a citizen, was very high on the list of countries that imprison a surprisingly high percentage of their population. And in fact, the U.S. ranked third in the world for a percent of its population incarcerated in 1980.
What is it now?
I believe that we've won. We're number one. Now, the company we were keeping in 1980 was instructive. I'd like people at home to kind of sit here and think for a minute about which two countries do you suppose were ahead of the United States in terms of percent of population locked up in 1980. While you're thinking of that, and I'm going to tell you, of course, if you remind me, Steve.
I will.
I could forget. while you're thinking about that, who was our company in winning the sweepstakes for locking up as many people as possible, the other thing going on in the early 80s and really for the next decade was a little movement in this country called Scared Straight. I wonder how many people out there remember seeing the video movie, which I believe Channel 3 in Champaign played numerous times in the 1980s, all about taking troubled teenagers into a prison and have them sit across a room from hardened murderers and rapists and have them describe how, if you ended up in their institution, they would make mincemeat of you in short shrift. I became fascinated by the fact that people seem to be saying, that the media seemed to be announcing to us all, that we were all apparently aware of the fact, weren't we, that if you ended up in prison, you could expect to be brutalized. And I thought, my goodness, we're locking up a record number of people, and we're locking them into prisons that apparently don't have any interest in making a person better. They only have an interest in reducing you to something less than human. And I think it's at that moment that I began to feel that all of my reading about Nazi Germany was coming to a head. What do you do if you're the citizen of a country that you love, that you think is, generally speaking, exemplary, and you discover something about it that strikes you as deeply wrong? There, how's that for an answer to that question?
And tell us the answer to the question you posed listeners.
Oh, yes. Number one in the world, I believe, in 1980 for locking up its populace was, no surprise, the Soviet Union. And number two was South Africa, a segregated, racist society fighting against a freedom movement on the part of its poor black citizens.
So during the time of apartheid in South Africa?
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And what percentages are we talking about then and now?
Oh, my. I don't have the numbers in front of me, and I suppose that having a sort of a quantitative bent, I should have brought them. But
well, it shows this show is unrehearsed.
There you go. Shows this show is unrehearsed. In a way, I think this is kind of one of those days when I wonder to what extent the facts matter. I think the public knows that we've been building prisons like mad in this country for the last 20 years. I was consulting with higher education people in California in the early 90s, and it was soon to be the case that California would spend more money on prisons than it would on higher education.
Mm-hmm.
Going back 20 years, penitentiaries, prisons had been a tiny fraction of the cost of higher education. But there was a real conflict over the dollars. The early 90s was a period of recession, and California's budget was in tatters, and they were cutting way back on higher education spending, at least in part because of the costs of all the new prisons and the cost of not building them but maintaining them.
There's a whole industry, in fact, that's grown up around just how to design the best, most efficient prisons.
Well, and as
architectural
know,
firms,
yep.
construction firms, technology firms that deal solely with prisons in America.
Right. And as you know, there's also been a movement to, quote, privatize prisons, mm-hmm. which simply means that the government can effectively put out the handling of prisoners to the lowest bidder and then wash its hands of conditions in prisons on the grounds that, well, you know, we wrote rules and they're apparently following them and we saved some money.
Now, this program deals with issues of religion and spirituality, but also of just ethics. And when I ask you what you might be interested in talking about on this program, and you said not only U.S. prison policy, but you said a Christian view. Now, we can talk about this strictly from an ethical perspective, but you wanted to bring in a specific religious tradition of which you're a part. Why is that?
Well, I'm fascinated by the fact that the last two presidents of the United States, including the current one, seem to feel the need during their campaigns for president to affirm their strong belief, for example, in the death penalty. President Clinton flew back to Arkansas to oversee the execution of a severely retarded man who probably didn't even understand what was happening to him. And it's well known that Texas, under President Bush, executed an extraordinarily large number of people. And I'm fascinated by the fact that two Southern Baptists, who I assume buy into the notion of God's grace and the potential for redemption right up until the moment of death, the acceptance of God's grace, should be such advocates of something that obviously puts an end to the opportunity for an individual to receive grace. It would seem to me that if you really believe that every sinner, that Jesus died for the sins of every sinner and that every sinner has an opportunity to repent, you would be massively against the death penalty. You would want every person who has committed the kind of crime that ought to, in some theology, lead to an eternity in hell. You would want these people to have every opportunity, if you truly forgive the sinner, truly care about your fellow man, you'd want him to have every chance to accept God's grace and repent of his or her sins. But our leaders who claim to be born again apparently don't buy into the notion that other people have an equal right to be born again, or at least ought to be given maximum opportunity to do that. And I find that fascinating because I also think that we were raised to believe, weren't we, that Christianity treated everyone, even outsiders, even non-Christians, as equally valuable, equally human, equally subject to God's grace. And yet, increasingly, we are drawing lines domestically and internationally that declare certain people non-human somehow. I feel that the public rhetoric of prison policy is a very anti-Christian, anti-egalitarian movement, and it bothers me very much that it is.
Let me give phone numbers where listeners can call and ask a question or make a comment. This is a live program every Sunday afternoon from 5 to 6 Central Time here on WILL, and listeners may join the conversation. If you're hearing this program anywhere in the continental U.S., for example, on the Internet or outside the Champaign-Urbana area, you may call us free, 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WILL, the call letters of the station. In Champaign-Urbana, you may reach several local lines by punching in 333-9455. So locally, 333-WILL. We're talking with David Eisenman today about a Christian view of U.S. prison policy. David, what do you take to be the main parts of the current policy in the U.S.?
Well, Steve, in the first place, before I answer that question, I'd like to say I hope people will call in, and I'm not looking today for a fight. I want to know if I'm nuts. Am I the only person who is intensely uncomfortable about what we're doing in our prisons? Am I the only person who heard what happened in Abu Ghraib in Iraq, where good American young people in the military appear to have turned into abusers of prisoners fairly easily? Am I the only person who connects that behavior with what's been going on for the last 25 years in terms of desensitizing us to what goes on in prisons? I hope people will call up and say something.
Well, we have several waiting. Let's go to line one. You're on Keeping the Faith.
Yeah, thank you very much for doing this topic. It seems long overdue and rarely done. My question, a couple questions I have is, number one, I'm curious why homosexual rape is considered normal and accepted and how the state escapes liability for taking people into custody in their care and then allowing them to be brutalized. The second question I have is, why are 3 out of 4 inmates allowed to do drugs? Which is pretty ironic because most of the offenders are drug offenders, and yet we seem to be able to deliver drugs. There is no drug-free prison in America. The third question I had was why there was no discussion when we built a $28 million expansion to the courthouse, an $11 million expansion to the jailhouse. Not one discussion was had about why we would need more jail space, more court space, and I'll hang up and listen to that.
And that third question is a local question for listeners in Indiana and farther away from Champaign-Urbana in this county. There's a recent construction of both a new courthouse and jailhouse. But let's go back to question number one, which was about...
No. I've got a better idea.
Right.
Let's go to the next caller. I'm willing to make a list. It's early early in the hour.
All right. We'll bring in caller number two. Go ahead, please.
I just wanted to say that I agree with Mr. Eisenman and have been wondering why more attention hasn't been called to this. And now I find out that we're on top as far as prison population, percentage of a population in prison. What the heck is going on here? I mean, maybe most people just have their heads in the sand like ostriches. There's something bad happening in this country, and more people need to be talking about it. That's all I've got to say. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your comment. Well, let's go on to line four, our toll-free line. You're on Keeping the Faith.
Thank you. Great topic. I do agree with you completely because I believe that with our politicians speak about this, there seems to be a disconnect because many of the same politicians that are for the death penalty, you know, people going at the end of their life, are very much pro-life and speak about how, you know, we shouldn't have abortion and so on, and they can be very much for protecting life at the beginning, but they seem to lose the Christian concept that people can change their lives and that people can transform. And I think another disconnect is we've really lost the idea of rehabilitation. I know that many people, there were in the past many abuses of people doing labor in prison, which was, you know, very hard labor and stuff. But I think that as a Christian ethic, the ethic of work and, you know, work being a very good thing, I think that we've lost that in a sense, and that there are productive ways that people in prison can work and do jobs and not just work releases outside the prison, but within the prison, but actually have them learn tangible job skills so that when they leave, they are not going back into, you know, whatever they were into before, drugs, crime, whatever got them into that they leave prison with a better sense of self and actually a very tangible job skill that they can apply when they get out. And that's all. And thank you very much.
Actual rehabilitation. Thank you for the call. We'll go now to line one. Yes, you're on Keeping the Faith.
Yes. Thank you. I call in often, but anyhow, this is a program about keeping the faith, and I wanted to tell David, I don't know him, but he's not nuts. I mean, this is absolutely despicable behavior, and all I can say is he's not nuts. I don't think any kind of that behavior is acceptable, and I'll hang up and listen to the response, so just reassure him he's not nuts. Thank you.
I'm already reassured.
Spoken by a nurse as well. Let's go to line two. You're on Keeping the Faith.
Hi, my name is Rick. I think that it's an interesting discussion and question about the death penalty, specifically. I think it's also interesting to look at who is on death row, where they come from, what their crimes are. And, of course, it's interesting in this state because the governor called for a moratorium on executions before he left office recently.
And in terms of who is on, who is in prison and on death row, would you want to comment on that?
Well, I think that you don't find a lot of white-collar crime, no matter how many pensioners they hurt drastically. Or there are different sorts of crimes that warrant a call for a death penalty, usually heinous, violent crimes. But there are other people who do a lot of really evil things who wouldn't make it necessarily because perhaps more money is involved. They have more legal representation. It's typically poorer people.
And often minorities.
And I'm told by authorities that almost all street-level crime, which is where our prisons get populated from, involves drugs. Even domestic violence can be traced back to drug abuse.
And alcohol, yes.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for the call. Let's go to line three. You're on Keeping the Faith.
Yeah. Another question I had was about the lack of infrastructure for parolees. The church seems to be conspicuously absent as a whole on providing services, housing, education for folks that have convictions and felonies on their record. It's amazing to me that we lock people up and then expect them and then turn them back out to the community, and we have very little to offer them. In fact, they're legally disallowed out of the economy, and I'd like you to also address that at some point.
Thank you for the comment. We're talking about U.S. prison policy and particularly a Christian response to it. Our guest is David Eisenman, and he suggested that people call in with comments or questions for a while. Let's go to line one for another. Yes, you're on Keeping the Faith.
Hi, very nice topic. I want to thank you. You always have some great guests. I want to bring up a different issue. The state's attorney is very much involved in which reports become charges and which charges go to trial. And this, I think, is an even more important issue when you're asking in our county why we have a new jail and a bigger courthouse. We have a huge docket load, and actually I think if people understood the number of reports that were made versus the number of charges and the number of cases, they would be very surprised by what happens. I happen to be involved in the domestic violence field, and very rarely is domestic violence charged as domestic battery. Most often it is reduced to misdemeanor battery, and very often it is just not charged in the first place. So I think when we look at the prison system, we also need to look at who are we sending to prison. Are we sending truly violent offenders to prison? Are we sending drug addicts to prison? Or are we sending low-income people to prison? And are we really protecting our society, which I believe is the purpose of the whole system? So thank you very much.
And we have one more caller waiting on line two. You're on Keeping the Faith with our guest David Eisenman.
Thanks for taking my call. I want to thank the guest for doing what he's doing. I think that when we're looking at things like prison policy, we're also looking at everything that goes on in this country. For example, the way we treat our elderly people in nursing homes and the way we treat our children in schools. And it's just there continues to be the have and have-nots, the ones who are treated badly, the ones who are treated better. So I think when you're looking at things like that, you're really looking at everything in our society, and that even if people aren't really concerned about the prison population, it's equally important to look at this because it reflects other things in our society. So I just want to thank the guest for being concerned.
Thank you for the comment. And now let's let our guest, David Eisenman, respond to some of these issues raised by our wise callers.
Well, I feel enormously better and a whole lot less alone than when this hour began. I've taken notes as everyone's spoken, and I don't I'm not going to respond to everything exactly in order, but I do want to begin with that very uncomfortable topic that our first caller began with, which is what he referred to as homosexual rape in prison. How is it that we can tolerate it and the state can avoid any responsibility for this phenomenon? Before I say anything about it, I'll say that also bothered me intensely when I first saw Scared Straight 20 years ago. Here were teenage boys sitting across from hardened, middle-aged, very large prisoners who clearly were bodybuilders, and they were told, you come in here and I'm going to have you bent over and I will be sodomizing you within seconds because you're a cute kid. And I think we, in the first place, we want to get our language clear. There is nothing about homosexual rape that really is homosexual in the usual term of the word. There's everything about homosexual rape that is rape. Rape is an act of aggression. It's an act of anger. It rarely has as much to do with being attracted to the victim as people think. I've learned that much from reading about rape. What goes on in prison isn't a result of prison being filled with people who would call themselves or who would be called by others homosexuals. It is filled with lots of very angry, strong men who have taken who have had every bit of control in their lives taken away from them by the prison. But having said that, let's get back to the topic. How in the world can we live in a society that takes for granted that if young people are put in prison, they will be brutalized? And if anybody doubts that that's the society we live in, let's pay attention to what goes on primetime television night after night. Anybody who's seen Law and Order knows that when Briscoe is interrogating any young perp or even witness, and he says, you cooperate with me or I will. What he says right after that is, I will put you in a holding cell with about 500-900-pound guys who will make you their wife. Now, it's very hard to get to the bottom of how much of this is myth that police and prison authorities want out there, hoping that it will, quote, scare people straight and keep them out of prison. And how much of it is real? Well, it turns out a great deal of it is real. We have some statistics about people getting AIDS in prison. We've been taking HIV tests of people on the way into prison, and we test them again later, and guess what? They have HIV. Now, whether it's consensual or rape behavior that's leading to this, and by the way, that need not be sexual behavior. Someone else brought up how in the world can we run prisons that are filled with drugs? You could obviously pick up HIV from a needle. But the idea that either of those behaviors goes on in large quantity in our prisons is absolutely outrageous. We're spending huge amounts of money, $20,000, $30,000 per year per prisoner to keep people incarcerated in this country. And apparently we can't protect prisoners from each other, nor can we protect us from the sneaky suspicion that some people are having a better time in prison than ever before. Now, let's get down to cases. It was predictable when Jeffrey Dahmer was put in prison that he would be murdered in prison. It would have been predictable, except most of us weren't paying attention, that when Father Shanahan, the notorious child abuser, quote, out of, I believe, Massachusetts, was put in prison, that some prisoner would kill him. Both of those things happened. On the other hand, we found out that John Wayne Gacy, no, it's not John Wayne Gacy, who was I'm forgetting the name, but the murderer of a large number of nurses all at once.
Richard Speck.
Thank you. Richard Speck, we discovered in the early 90s, had been having a grand old time in prison. He and his buddies had a video camera, and they photographed themselves doing all sorts of crazy sexual games that they are apparently enjoying. And I'm sure that this must have really driven the families of his victims mad, thinking that here is this absolutely outrageous man who didn't get the death penalty and then ended up in the top hierarchy of the prisoners running the prison. Why is it that prisoners run prisons in this country? Why is it that drugs are available? May I suggest that the last caller who said what we say about our prisons is also what we say about our schools and our nursing homes, she's right on. We want certain services in this society at the moment, but we apparently aren't willing to pay for them. if we are going to build prisons in huge quantities, we had better, I think, commit to making them the kinds of places that we want them to be. And I think that's what this whole discussion is about. What is it we want our prisons to be? How about another round of calls, those of you who are listening? What would you want our prisons to be? Now, while you're thinking about that, and before the phones start winking over here, let me say a word or two on the subject. One of our callers said, what happened to the notion of rehabilitation? What happened to the notion of working in prison? This is embarrassing. I'm going to bring up a specific case, and I hope the family will forgive me. I am aware of a family friend whose son has been sentenced to 30 years without hope of parole at age 19 because he sexually experimented with other boys who were younger than he. There's not the slightest suggestion that the boys themselves ever turned him in because he attacked them. It was experimentation. My impression is parents found out about it. But it included acts that under our current statutes are considered extremely heinous. And here's this young man put in prison for 30 years. He was, of course, brutalized immediately. He was put in the system, and within the first week he was beaten up. And it is not clear, because he's been incredibly reticent about the whole thing from the beginning, whether he himself was sexually abused. But I'd like to point out that I now read sentencing very carefully in the News Gazette, and conscious murderers, cold-blooded murderers get 15 years. And we're putting a 19-year-old boy in prison for 30 years for sexual experimentation with other youth. I'm sure their parents were horrified. I'm sure they were upset. I'm sure they wanted to see him as the attacker and abuser. But how can you defend? Show me one politician who will stand up in America today and say that when we locked up hundreds of daycare workers in the 80s and early 90s on that national hysteria about abusive people in daycare centers, or that everybody who comes anywhere near a child is immediately seen as some sort of predatory child abuser who ought to be stigmatized for life. Who defends these people? And yet, aren't they absolutely the people who need counseling, correction, assistance? We have a winking light there, Steve.
Let's go to call number one. Caller number one.
Yes, hi. Me again. This relates to the rehab issue. I've seen several programs about rehab. Prisoners who have rehabbed animals of different kinds. I wanted to hear your guest's response to that. Is that a possibility? Because I know we have ample need for that rehab. So have him speak to that. Now hang up and listen off the air. Thank you.
Well, that was the perfect question, because that is the question. Are certain people absolutely doomed to a lifetime pattern of such antisocial behavior that we need to either kill them or lock them up permanently? And apparently, a large segment of the population has come to the conclusion that, yes, the answer is yes. You cannot rehab certain things. We're told that child abusers, for example, sexual predators, are among the most resistant to all treatment of all psychosexual disorders. For the moment, let's just assume that were true. This led to a fantasy of mine something like 20 years ago when I was in my fifth year of obsession with this subject. I said, I think my solution is North Dakota. Now, if anybody's listening from North Dakota, I hope you will understand that I'm speaking metaphorically here. But it did dawn on me that penal colonies, places where you simply can't get out, but on the other hand have some level of freedom and are indeed put to work, wouldn't necessarily be a bad idea. And my first modest thinking along the subject was, well, if somebody assaults another person three times, I really should say if somebody batters another person, say, three times, maybe we ought to say, okay, buddy, you don't seem to be able to keep your fists or whatever it is, your gun, your knife to yourself. And while the rest of the time you're a productive citizen, so forth, society needs protection from you.
Three strikes and you're out.
Yes, this would be three strikes, but they would involve violence against people. We use that phrase. I want everyone out there to understand that in California, the three strikes could be three
marijuana use.
Or three experiences of stealing canned beans from a grocery store. I mean, they're locking people up for life for crimes whose total property value isn't even $100. But let's say that we really did need protection from violent people. Does this mean that those violent people have to be the recipients of $20,000 a year in taxpayer dollar to sit idle in a cell? Why not have a place where, to the extent that they can behave themselves, they can work and live somewhat semi-normal lives? In my North Dakota, you would have no alcohol. You would have no cars. You would have curfews. You would have a whole lot of restriction on your life. On the other hand, and by the way, there would be jails. And for people who still couldn't keep their fists to themselves or keep their hands off other people's property, there would be periods in which you would be incarcerated. But there are people who can't control themselves. It doesn't necessarily mean that our protection requires us to put them in a jail cell. But we have another caller.
I'm going to wait with that caller for just a minute because we are halfway through the program, and I do need to say that you're listening to Keeping the Faith on AM 580 WILL. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for the program. Our guest today is David Eisenman. We're talking about U.S. prison policy and particularly a Christian response to that policy. Keeping the Faith programs are supported in part by the University YMCA at the University of Illinois, where I'm the executive director. The Y is the oldest religious institution at the university, started by students 131 years ago on campus, and since that time has been helping develop student leaders by providing opportunities for reflection, social action, community service. One of our big programs going on this summer, is called Dump and Run, where we recycle household goods, furniture, all sorts of things, even cars, for people who would like to donate them, get a tax write-off as they donate to the Y. We then sell those things to entering students and others in the community in the fall. The big sale will be on the 26th, 27th, and 28th at the University Stock Pavilion. That's in August. We're still collecting this summer, and the next time we'll be collecting is starting August 2nd through the 7th of August. So if people would like to donate things as you're moving out of apartments, for example, this time of year, if you have things you can't pack in your car or truck to take somewhere else, bring it by the University YMCA at 1001 South Wright Street in Champaign. We take all sorts of things because students need all sorts of things and others when they start school in the fall. So, again, August 2 through 7, that's Monday through Saturday from 9 to 3:30, we'll be accepting items. Again, we've about finished filling our third semi-trailer truck full of these things. So we have a wonderful collection. Well, we do have a caller waiting on line one. Let's go to that patient person. You're on the air.
Good evening. I've got a rejoinder to a caller very early in the show.
Fine.
Who seemed to be lamenting the fact that when Champaign County taxpayers were asked to pass a sales tax for public safety, they built a jail and a youth detention center and an 11-room courthouse, and no one seemed to ask, why do we have to do this? Well, I'm one of the people who did ask. I serve with Steve. He's one of my 26 other colleagues on the Champaign County Board. And we did ask this, and I couldn't overcome the things that statisticians and criminologists were telling us about the trends and how many cases we'd likely have to be making room for and how many beds we'd need in the satellite jail. But we did decide to do something about anti-recidivism. And I'd like everyone to know that 5% of the funding stream, the sales tax receipts that fund the court, the youth jail, and the satellite jail for adults, goes to anti-recidivism programs. And this year, we had $184,000 to spend on CASA. That's the court-appointed special advocate program in Champaign County. Urban League programs for teens. There's a peer court. We've got counseling programs. We have a terrific education program in our jail for kids. So I just want people in Champaign County to know that your county board has thought about doing something other than jailing people, and I'm pleased to let folks know that, that part of the money that went to build the jail and the courthouse also goes for anti-recidivism.
Thank you for the call, and since I am not a candidate for re-election to the county board, I'll allow the caller to identify me as a current member of the county board, which is accurate. David, you want to respond?
I'm very glad for that call, and I'm very glad for the conscience of such people who serve on boards like the county board and who bring to that task a broader view of the problem here than just one of building institutions. But that's the third or fourth caller who has talked about recidivism and the question of we have a thing called the Department of Corrections, but are we doing any correcting or are we merely brutalizing? Incidentally, there was I'll have to confess something here. Here I am on a talk show, I guess, or a call-in show, but I never listened to them. However, I did happen to hear one about a year ago in which a local judge was on the air talking about criminal cases and so forth. And I called up and asked him when was the last time he'd visited a prison. And he said he certainly wouldn't go there. The places were way too dangerous for him to visit. And I said, doesn't it then bother your conscience any that you send people there? And he was very quick to say, no, it didn't bother him the slightest. He'd send as many as he could. Well, you can all guess which judge that was. But I thought it was kind of amusing that that he was quick to tell us that he buys into the notion that prisons are hellholes, that he himself wouldn't even visit one, which I think raises a very interesting question here. How many people out there would be willing to join a nonpartisan, possibly church-based citizen group that would fight for the right to visit prisons unannounced and inspect directly the conditions in them? I don't know how many people out there know it, but it's harder and harder for reporters even, who are supposed to have freedom to poke around in our society, to get inside and find out what's going on in our prisons.
Let me give the phone numbers for those who would like to make a comment. This is a live program every Sunday afternoon from 5 to 6 called Keeping the Faith on WILL, and you may call 1-800-222-9455, 1-800-222-WILL, or in Champaign-Urbana, where the program originates at the University of Illinois. You may punch in 333-9455, and we do have a caller on line 4. Go ahead, please.
Is this line 4?
Yes, this is line 4.
All right. First, I want to thank you for having this person on your show and thank him for what he's talking about. He's speaking to something that I am hearing that there's other people think as I do. But I'm wondering if he doesn't think that the prison problem is just one part of the way we're thinking in this country. I mean, you look at one caller alluded to this in the schools and the nursing homes, but it seems to me that when you turn on the TV, you hear this same type of thinking that there's you and there's us, and if you aren't us, then you need to have something done to you. So I'll hang up and let him talk. Thank you.
A response from David Eisenman, our guest today.
I appreciate that comment, and I want to respond to it by responding to an earlier comment. One of our callers said, isn't it interesting that the churches are not involved much in working with parolees, in providing halfway houses, opportunities for people coming out of prisons, or maybe even, if we can use the term, anti-recidivism support, attempts to engage people who are engaged in, what shall we say, pre-criminal behavior, dealing with troubled teens, things of that sort.
Although CASA, for example, does draw from synagogues and mosques and churches for its volunteers who are advocates.
I think that's the first thing we should do is say that there are things going on. I mean, again, we shouldn't feel helpless here about attempts to do something about the general problem of crime and alternatives to prison punishment. I'm delighted to know about the anti-recidivism efforts that are supported by our tax dollars. But Steve, maybe you can tell us a little bit more about what local churches are doing. CASA is a wonderful example of volunteers trained to be advocates for kids who desperately need some adult to help them because they're in trouble and they're already in the system and they need somebody to understand their point of view and keep this thing from becoming an adult criminal routinized industrial process. What else is going on?
Well, there are, I guess, organizations on two levels. One are evangelical groups, particularly with evangelical Christians, who have set up organizations to try to witness to, evangelize, convert prisoners, and they have surprisingly good access to prisons. And then there are more liberal or progressive groups that say things like job training, education, trying to give people even basic reading skills so that they have a better chance to make a living once they get out. Those sorts of things are going on as well. And of course, within the system itself, there are some efforts, some provided by tax dollars, but many of the volunteers come from religious organizations who are making some efforts. But the numbers are overwhelming. The number of people, the prisons are full, and
yes.
We have a couple of callers waiting, so maybe they want to come in on this, too. Let's go to line one. You're on Keeping the Faith. Yes, go ahead, please. Line one.
Oh, hello. I'm very interested in what you're talking about. I'm an Episcopalian and have connections with both the I'm so sorry. Should I turn this down?
Yes, turn the radio down. Thanks.
Let me.
All right. Are you still there?
Yes, I am.
Great.
Hello.
Yes, we can hear you.
I'm very interested in this, and I think that the Chapel of St. John the Divine on campus would be very interested in this too. I have had experience of visiting a couple of young people in the last year. I'm 63 years old, trying to counsel them for drug offenses, and I'm very interested in this, and I think that probably the two St. John chapels, both St. John the Divine and St. John the Baptist, the Catholic chapel, would be very interested in this. This is very, very important. If you would send something to me, I'm Professor Castle at the University of Illinois. I'm in the Spanish, Italian, Portuguese department. If you'll send me some literature, I'd be very interested.
Well, thank you very much. And we have another caller waiting on line two. Go ahead, please.
Hello. It sounds like when these people get out of prison, I mean, obviously, there are people who don't stay forever. My question is, what does the prison do, if anything, to prepare people to leave, to give them some kind of job skills or something? Because it sounds like they would just be going from an authoritarian situation out into the world where they may not even be able to function.
I'm afraid you're all too right about that. Prisons, as you know, used to be famous for that was where your license plate got made. There were prison industries. Unfortunately, labor unions, possibly correctly, argued that there was an element of unfair competition involved in having prison labor do certain things. And we have long anecdotal records of especially chain gang sort of activities in the South in which prison directors hired out the labor and pocketed the value of the work. Unfortunately, the reform seems to have been to eliminate work altogether for a very large number of prisoners. Again, drawing on that case that I mentioned earlier of the young man who enters the prison system at 19 and won't get out till he's 49, the prison can cogently argue there's no point in engaging in any job training for him right now because he's not going to be on the market for 30 years anyway. That poor kid is waiting in line to be able to earn a dollar or two a week as an assistant in the kitchen or in the laundry. In the meantime, his days are filled with idle nothingness, work out, possibly watch some television. This is certainly not an environment that is inclined, in my mind, to improve anyone. You may also know that state and federal agencies used to pay tuition for prison inmates who were capable of doing college-level work, and there were universities and colleges that were prepared to offer courses in prison, but we've decided that's coddling prisoners, and so we've taken away a number of the financial programs that might have led some prisoners to gain college-level expertise. I think that there's been an utter collapse of any belief in this country that we want to spend any money making people in prisons any better. Prisons appear to me to have descended to a level of punishment and brutality. And yet, I know people in the corrections field who would violently disagree with me, and obviously none of them are listening to this program. But as I said earlier on, I want to know, I'd like to know as an individual, where the myth that prisons are hellholes and where the claim that we are still engaged in corrections actually meet in reality. And I'm bothered by the fact that our press can't even get in to find out.
We have another caller waiting on our toll-free line, 1-800-222-9455. You're on the air.
Yes, I saw stuff on the History Channel talking about the history of prisons. Maybe you should ask this question to the general public. When they use the word penitentiary, is it a cage or is it for penance and how our society feels on that issue?
Excellent. I'm glad you picked up on that. And the history of prisons is very interesting. I don't know how many people know it, but it was the members of various religious groups that invented the notion of a penitentiary, a place where you were to be penitent. I was reading a bit today in the history of prisons in general and American prisons in particular, and it may shock people to know that in some of the New York prisons of the 18th century, for example, there had to be strict silence maintained at all times. You weren't jabbering. You were supposed to be at work, and you were highly regimented. They got you up at a certain hour. They put you to labor, but you were not to talk. And if you were talked, you were immediately corrected. This is interesting. We seem to have given up on the notion of redemption, and I guess that'll bring us back to, again, why I thought some comment about Christianity in prisons was appropriate on Steve's program. As he says, we don't have to insist on a religious theme to these programs, but I wonder, as Christians, if we are still a majority Christian nation, something we won't be soon. But even if you drop the Christian tradition and you start looking at other traditions, I think some sense of the ability of grace, however it is understood in different religious traditions, to break through in the heart of a misbehaving person to turn him or her back into a productive member of a community. That idea seems to exist in most religious traditions, but it was a central idea in some of the first institutional ways of dealing with crime, namely penitentiaries. People don't realize we didn't always have prisons. After all, in small town medieval times, you didn't even need a jail. You locked somebody up in the stocks, perhaps, if he had misbehaved for a day or two, and there was public humiliation and some pain and suffering. But then you went back to work, by God, because we needed you. So you're right. The very word penitentiary derives from a religious-based notion that people who had misbehaved could be redeemed. We do understand that mental illness and that incapacity and possibly total addiction to behavior or substances can make some people irredeemably in need of segregation from the rest of us. That's why I mentioned earlier the notion of penal colonies is maybe a more humane way of dealing with people on whom we have little hope of for whom we have little hope of true correction. If you really can't control yourself for one reason or another, that still shouldn't mean that we punish you for that. It should mean that we find a way to keep ourselves safe and give you as humane a life as you're capable of living. But I don't see any thinking of that sort going on. Am I missing something?
Let me slip in a question of my own before we go to another caller. Doesn't it bother people, though, David, if there isn't some sort of retribution when someone has done a violent crime to an innocent person, if that person just gets away with it,
yes,
in a humane rehabilitation centered, I mean, doesn't that offend your sense of justice?
This is, of course, one of the traditional arguments for punishment. The first thing, obviously, is protection of the public. If there is someone out there who is truly dangerous, we want him put someplace where he can't hurt us. The second obvious reason for doing this is as deterrence. If we don't see that other people who commit crimes come to some unpleasant comeuppance, we could believe that other people would be inclined to do what they do. This, I think, clearly applies to things like stealing. Murders is curious. It turns out that the vast majority of murderers probably could not have been deterred by knowing that other murderers receive draconian punishment. So many murders are crimes of passion that it's hard to believe that at the time they were making any connection between punishment and what they were doing. But you're right. Retribution is an ancient demand that the public, especially victims, somehow or other need to know, quote, that the person who did this to my loved one is going to suffer. I think that the Christian response to that is to look into our own hearts and ask whether we are not demanding something that is only God's. Vengeance is the Lord's, I think. Not that. I mean, there should be deterrence. I think no one should see a person who commits a heinous crime simply walk away or especially be celebrated for it. O.J. Simpson, I suppose, is the poster boy for what's wrong with our system at the moment. Here we are filling our prisons with record numbers of people, and yet a man who I think the vast majority of the public believes probably killed his wife continues to golf, has even found financial ways to protect himself by putting all of his money into annuities so they can't be attached. But I'm beginning to go on, and we do have a caller.
Let's go to line one. You're on Keeping the Faith.
Hi. Actually, my question slash comment has to do with what you were just talking about. I've long been concerned about prison reform, and my family, I guess we together were victims of a violent crime. My cousin was murdered by her husband many years ago, and I had to spend a lot of heartfelt time in thinking about that, and I realized that it didn't change my thinking about what I felt needed to happen in prisons, that even though we had this great loss, still deep in my heart, I didn't want him to suffer in a way that really truly wasn't fair. I felt like his life was already ruined by his actions, and it was a crime of passion, so to speak. And so I haven't felt deterred from that, but I've wondered about this, you know, how many people react to something like that, how you can really look for vengeance. And even though I don't practice Christianity, I have a spiritual practice that really led me to the point of getting peaceful about that and coming to terms with that, and I felt grateful that I was able to do that, and I just appreciate further comments on that, and thank you very much.
Thank you.
I have in front of me Helen Prejean's Dead Man Walking. People may know that a movie was made of this book. This is a Catholic nun who found herself becoming an advocate for some witnessing of people who are on death row. And she has come directly up against this whole question of vengeance, of the desire for families. The word closure is thrown around a lot, and I think most people are thoroughly disgusted with the word. This never closes. If you lose a loved one to a violent crime, you're never going to forget it. And watching the criminal die, often in a defiant state, doesn't seem to bring any lasting pleasure to anyone. I think that let's talk about the extremes of this particular continuum. In medieval times, when in Christian Europe, it was widely believed that if you died in mortal sin, you were going to go directly to hell and burn forever. You may know that if you truly hated somebody for something he had done to you or your family, your best revenge was to lure him into a what was known as a mortal sin. For example, send in a harlot and get him into intercourse and then murder him in the middle of his sin so that you're sure that not only is he dead, which occurs in time here on earth, but he's in hell for eternity.
No chance for repentance.
Exactly. Right. I mean, you think that, of course, I mean, obviously good theology would say that God gives everyone a chance, even in his last second of consciousness. He could presumably repent of his sins and go to heaven, but never
or
mind.
Or in purgatory.
Or purgatory. But yes, thank you. It would never have been heaven. But people at least believed that this was somehow going to make them happy, was to send an enemy to hell, not only kill him, but kill him at a moment in which he is in sin and therefore going to go to hell. I have the awful feeling that this is, if they were to examine their hearts, the desire of an awful lot of people who have been very badly injured in our society. And Sister Fréjean certainly met people of that sort. But people may know that she's gone on to create an organization that tries to get victims and their families actually into dialogue with the people who committed the crimes. And the spiritual growth for people who've been willing to engage in what must be an extraordinarily wrenching process is apparently very great. So this is, I think, a very serious center of the matter. And in fact, again, in preparing for today, I came across a comment from George Will that I think captures this line of thinking beautifully. Will's defense of the death penalty, he admits, is sort of irrational. He says this, the American people favor capital punishment not primarily because they believe it's an effective deterrent, but because it satisfies a deeply felt moral intuition that there are some crimes for which death is the only proportionate punishment. And I think that's a psychological truth that can't be escaped. We could argue about it forever, but an awful lot of people are going to be for the death penalty because they can think of some crime so bad that the only outcome they can imagine that would ever make them at all comfortable is the death of the person who did the thing. But since we're nearing the end of our time today, I'm going to be doing what Steve should do and just say I think when I saw Abu Ghraib on the news, that my conclusion was not that the young people who abused Arab prisoners did so because they'd seen bad movies. But I do think that they've grown up, these people, in an era that I find appalling. I'm 61 years old this year, and I do not remember this kind of vengeance, this attitude toward prisons as dead ends for bad people in which any abuse is okay. This was not the way I grew up, but this is the way our young people have grown up, and I think today's the beginning of our taking some action. I don't want to be like the Germans who watched Hitler take over and did nothing.
I want to thank our guest today, David Eisenman, who's been talking about U.S. prison policy from a religious perspective. Also, our many callers with their comments and questions. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for this Keeping the Faith program. Next week, our guest will be Cindy Shepherd, who will be talking about the preacher as minor poet. On August 8th, our guest will be Danny Otto, talking about the Amish and Mennonite relief sale in central Illinois. August 15, Paul Pluth, Mary in Church Life. Thank you for listening to Keeping the Faith.
Physicist Brian Green sees an elegant universe where baking a batch of cookies can yield surprising lessons about the fabric of the cosmos.
When you see an egg splattering in your kitchen, it's telling you something very deep about the Big Bang itself.
I'm Jim Fleming. Time, the Big Bang, and the nature of the universe. Next time on To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 7 here on WILL Urbana.
Campaign season hits its stride with this week's Democratic National Convention. I'm Tom Rogers. I'll be in Boston as part of Illinois Public Radio's coverage, focusing on what presidential politics means to people here in Illinois. Listen for reports from the convention beginning Monday on Morning Edition and the Afternoon Magazine, plus my comments on Will Blog, a running online journal. It's all on our website, will.uiuc.edu, and here on WILL Urbana.
Tonight in Champaign-Urbana, mostly cloudy with a small chance of showers. Patchy fog with the low in the upper 50s and northeast winds around 5 miles per hour. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy with a chance of showers, the high in the mid-70s with north winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, cloudy with a chance of showers, the low in the upper 50s with north winds around 10 miles per hour. It's 6 p.m. Central Time. This American Life is next.
WBE.